Robert Mirapol. Robert Mirapol is the younger son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. People may know, in 1953, when Robert was 6 years old, the United States government executed his parents for, quote, conspiring to steal the secret of the atomic bomb. For 30 years, he's been a progressive activist, author, and speaker. In 1990, he founded the Rosenberg Fund for Children here in Western Massachusetts, which provides for the educational and emotional needs of both targeted activist youth and children in this country whose parents have been harassed, injured, jailed, lost jobs, or died in the course of their progressive activities. Robert also has a new memoir, An Execution in the Family, which was published recently.
Glad to see you all out tonight. I always liked that introduction about being a speaker for 30 years. I was actually a very verbal child, and I've been speaking for more than 30 years. But on a more serious note, I'm going to get to Romney's foolproof death penalty, but I've been asked to give a more broader, both sort of historical and political background, everything from what happened to my parents in the 1950s to the USA Patriot Act, which forms the background that we live in today. So I'm going to focus on those more general questions first. It's almost 52 years since June 19th, 1953, when my parents were executed by the U.S. government. I believe my brother Michael and I are the only people in U.S. history to have had both their parents executed. And they were charged with and ultimately convicted and killed for the crime of, quote, conspiracy to commit espionage. What does that mean? And how did it happen? Well, what's the meaning of conspiracy? Well, what does conspiracy mean? It means simply that two or more people got together and planned to do something and took one act in furtherance of their plan. In other words, it's a planning crime. And the USA Patriot Act is filled with conspiracy clauses that carry the death penalty. Even before that act, for instance, Zacharias Moussaoui, you may know him as the supposed 20th hijacker, the person who was in jail on September 11th and therefore couldn't participate in the plan to fly the planes into the buildings. He is in prison, and he's charged with conspiracy. And, of course, the government is asking for the death penalty in his case. And if you think about that case and what the government is asking for, the government is saying, we don't want to kill someone for what they did. We want to kill someone for what they would have done if they could have done it, which strikes me as more than a little perverse. And who knows about Guantanamo and what will happen with these people labeled enemy combatants by the Bush administration. Now, why is all this happening? Why are we suddenly having the kind of case that my parents, that was like my parents' case? Well, it's happened and it's happening because the political climate of 2005 is frighteningly similar to that of 1953. Now, to give you some background on my parents' case, my father, Julius Rosenberg, was arrested in July of 1950, a few weeks after the Korean War began, and he was executed along with my mother a few weeks before it ended. So it was bracketed. This case was bracketed by a war, and a war was continuing throughout this entire period, which is a good portion of the McCarthy era. And because they were charged with this vague charge of conspiracy to commit espionage, the government did not have to produce any tangible evidence that anybody had stolen anything or given it to anybody. In fact, there was no such evidence presented at my parents' trial in terms of anybody testifying that they saw them do that. But the prosecutor, the sentencing judge, the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, and ultimately President Eisenhower, all said that my parents were being killed because they stole the greatest secrets known to mankind. And that was the secret of the atomic bomb. And that's what the case was known all about, even though that's not actually what they were charged with. In fact, the words atomic bomb never even appear in their indictment. And just to give you an idea about what they supposedly stole, the evidence introduced at their trial of the secret of the atomic bomb, I'm going to show you a blown-up version of it. This is, I don't know how well you can see this, but it looks like sort of a piece of pie. It says, cross-section A bomb not to scale. This is actually the exhibit, and this is the greatest secret known to mankind, and this is what two people were killed for supposedly conspiring to give to the Soviet Union. It's my only copy of this particular picture, but I'll leave it up here in case anybody wants to come up and take a look at it. Now, if we're looking at today, if we're jumping forward 50-plus years, there are several chilling parallels between my parents' case and the kind of case that we may see today, even though politically my parents, who were secular Jewish communists, couldn't be further apart from the Islamic fundamentalists who may face this kind of charge today. But if you look at it more analytically, in my parents' case, what the federal government was seeking to do was link the thing that the public feared the most at that time, which was the atomic bomb, to the people the public feared the most, which were communists. And it all happened during wartime. The Korean War was going on. Thousands were dying in Korea. In fact, on an average in this 3-year period, 1,000 American soldiers were killed a month. So the death rate was much higher than what we're seeing today. Now we look at today. What are federal prosecutors again doing? They're taking the thing that the public fears the most, weapons of mass destruction, and they're linking it to the kind of people the public's been taught to fear the most, Islamic fundamentalists, and of course where the Bush administration has figured out how to keep us in a perpetual state of war. 1,500 troops have been killed since we invaded and occupied Afghanistan and Iraq, and that number continues to grow. And the politically charged atmosphere of the 1950s that made it difficult to save my parents' lives, that same atmosphere presents a daunting challenge to anyone who wants to look critically at the kind of cases that are coming up today and to look critically at the death penalty in general. And the questions that we need to ask around these kind of issues are, will conspirators be killed because the perpetrators are already dead? The mass murderers who flew the planes into the buildings are all dead. So will we take revenge on peripheral figures like Zacharias Moussaoui? That question remains to be seen. Now, but we haven't seen the wave of capital conspiracy cases that I feared would take place after September 11th, at least not yet. But unfortunately, that's because things are even worse than I feared. Hundreds of people were detained in the United States, even over 1,000 after September 11th, and hundreds still remain in legal limbo in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And what is the administration trying to do with these detentions and what's going on in Guantanamo and people and ghost prisoners held in CIA facilities all over the world that we don't even know about? What they're trying to do is do an end run around our judicial system. What the U.S. government is saying vis-a-vis Guantanamo is that the U.S. courts have no power to review these cases because Guantanamo is beyond our country. It's beyond our jurisdiction. And by the way, they're right in that case. Guantanamo is a part of Cuba and should be a part of Cuba and was stolen from Cuba and is illegally occupied by the United States, but it's still under our control. Now, even after the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Center for Constitutional Rights and their clients in the case in dealing with Guantanamo in the case of Rasul, even after the court declared in a 6-3 vote, yes, these people do have the right to have their status determined, yes, they do have certain due process rights, now that the CCR and other groups are back in court arguing on their client's behalf, what's the government's arguing in the cases below. They're saying all the Supreme Court decided was that these people were able to file a paper in court challenging their status. But since these people really don't have any rights under our system, the court summarily has to deny their petitions. This is kind of truly bizarre, Kafkaesque kind of idea that you've got the right to file a piece of paper, but then the court has to throw out your case. So the status of the Guantanamo detainees hasn't really changed despite the Supreme Court ruling. So what's going on with all this? Well, it's really very simple. The President of the United States and his crew of people have essentially placed themselves above all law. At least they're trying to place themselves above all law. And there's a simple reason for that, and that's because this president and his cronies want no less than to run the world. Well, the problem with running the world is that that's both expensive and bloody. And you can't allow something like domestic dissent to undermine this kind of plan. So that's why we have the USA Patriot Act. It's not about fighting a terrorism. It's about racial profiling and squashing dissent. Now, I also want to talk in my last 5 minutes, I hope I still have 5 minutes, about capital punishment in general. You know, there are many reasons to oppose capital punishment, and I'm sure the vast majority of people in this room have heard them all, and I'm not going to go through them in great detail. The first one's what I call strategic reasons. And that means to me that capital punishment requires perfection. You can't afford to make a mistake. You can't say, whoops, and take it back. Someone's been executed. That's the end. But since human beings are incapable of perfection, it's inevitable that we're going to make a mistake and an innocent person is going to be killed. And yet, despite that, we have Governor Romney asking for a foolproof death penalty. Now, I don't want to talk as specifically as the first speaker did about this kind of concept. I want you to think about it also, though I totally agree with what was said, but think about it more generally. Has the government ever produced a perfect law? Can you imagine the idea of a foolproof tax system, a foolproof traffic system, a foolproof big dig? The very idea of generating something that is foolproof is absurd. And the idea of applying this to a matter of life and death, that's beyond absurd. That's an atrocity. And then there are political reasons to oppose capital punishment. Once you give the government the power of life and death, we all know from our experience with governments that governments will abuse the power they have, and we don't want them to have that power. And we all know that capital punishment is unfair, that there's racism involved, that there's classism involved, poor people are inevitably on death row, that there's even sexual oppression involved. I mean, there's at least one case in Texas when prosecutors argued that they should execute someone who was convicted rather than send them to prison because this was a gay man and that's where he wanted to be with all these other men in prison. I wish I had the cite for that case. And we know that some pretty bizarre things go on in Texas. The other thing is capital punishment is arbitrary and capricious. We heard that the Supreme Court has now said that it's unconstitutional to execute people who are under 18. Well, think about that for a minute. Somebody goes out and they commit a murder, and 1 minute before their 18th birthday, and they can't be executed. Another person goes out 1 minute after their 18th birthday and does the same thing, and they can be executed. Now, people will say, well, you got to draw the line somewhere. But when it's a matter of life and death, the way to draw the line is to say no to capital punishment entirely. And there are also, of course, religious and ethical reasons for opposing capital punishment. It's just plain wrong. But for all those reasons, and I think when talking to an audience of people who I think largely agree on this issue, I think it's very important for us to think about strategy. How are we going to win? And I do think we're going to win. But how are we going to win permanently? And I think ultimately the way we're going to win is for people in the United States to come to see capital punishment as a human rights abuse. That the great declaration, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on December 10th, 1948, listed the right to life as the most basic right. Now, we can argue about when life begins, but there's no doubt that someone who's over 18, a living, breathing human being, is alive and has a right to life, and the execution of that person is a basic abuse of that right and is a human rights abuse. And that's why I've gotten involved with the new organization, Murder Victims Families for Human Rights. We are all people who are opposed to capital punishment but have had a family member either executed or murdered or disappeared. And I like this particular perspective as a human rights abuse because until we view and come to view capital punishment as a human rights abuse, there will always be those who are seeking political gain who will call for the death penalty whenever a particularly heinous crime inflames public opinion. And it's because, for instance, that people in Europe have come to view capital punishment as a human rights abuse that you didn't see widespread calls for the reinstatement of capital punishment in the European Union in the wake of September 11th. And the second thing I think we must do is place capital punishment within a broader context. We have to always beware of those who counsel us to give up our freedoms in order to increase our security, in order to protect ourselves. What I say to them and to people that are arguing against that is don't fall into the freedom versus security trap. Attack the assumption. Where is proof that giving up freedom will increase our security? History teaches us that we'll be less free, but not more secure. In fact, we'll end up living in fear of our own security forces. Now, some of you may wonder why I keep bringing up questions of civil liberties when dealing with capital punishment. Well, it seems to me that both civil liberties and capital punishment involve the intersection of personal sovereignty and governmental power. That's why the expansion of the death penalty and the contraction of civil liberties always go hand in hand. We can't let our government expand the scope of the death penalty and make war on our civil liberties in the name of making war on terror. The government of the United States and those in the public fool no one but themselves when we cover up systematic policies that condone torture and foster human rights abuses. We can't let Bush and others destroy life, freedom, and the rule of law in the name of protecting it. Thank you.